This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Good evening, everyone. My name's Alison, and I'm secretary here for the CAS, the Canberra Archaeological Society. Welcome to this great night and great venue. On behalf of the Society, I would like to acknowledge that we meet on the lands of the Ngunnawal, Ngunnawal, Narigo and Ngambri people, and we respect their knowledge and commitment to this country. Our guest speaker tonight is Wally Bell. He's a Ngunnawal elder, and he'll speak on how, as an Aboriginal man, he keeps alive the cultural and spiritual elements when dealing with a very scientific approach to archaeology on his country. Welcome, Wally. Nearly forgot, a very important part of the night will be an opportunity for questions, but it'll be at the end of Wally's lecture. Please don't ask any questions until you actually are holding the microphone, because this is all being recorded tonight. And if we don't have the question, we won't know what the answer's all about. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. And thank you guys for coming along to listen to my spiel, I guess, about my culture and how it relates with archaeology. I guess since we're on my country, Ngunnawal country, I should say welcome. And I'll do that with a few words in Ngunnawal language. Dara nunna, dara Ngunnawal, yumulundi. This land is Ngunnawal land, and welcome. So to begin with, I'll try and work this gadget. Who am I? There's a lot there, I guess, and that's probably because of the fact that I do a lot. You don't really realise how much you do until you try to write it up and be a little bit concise in what you're writing about. This has been concise, I'm sorry. As you can see, and like I said, I'm a Ngunnawal man. I grew up in rural country, in a little place called Jirrawa. It's where I learned all about my culture through my dad. My dad's no longer with us, but I still carry his spirit with me whenever I do anything. So, as you can see, I'm the oldest of seven children, and that then sort of, in a way, gives me the rite of passage to take over from my dad as being the elder of our clan group. My clan group is the Yar people. We come from Yass. Yass area. We don't really just live in Yass, but that's where we're from. That's our country. I've also got some qualifications too, so I'm allowed to talk about some stuff, you know, because nobody wants to listen to you unless you've got some sort of certificate and something. It's funny, isn't it? I did want to do archaeology, but I thought, well, I know all about my archaeology anyway, so. But I didn't want to be bound by those restrictions that are then placed on you when you're doing those sort of things as well. So as you can see, my organisation, the one that I chair, is the Buru, Ngunnawal Aboriginal Corporation. Buru is Ngunnawal for kangaroo. Then I also started up the Malangang, Traditional Aboriginal Land Care Group. That's I set that up because of the fact that I do a lot of work on country, and that's, as you can see right down the bottom there, I'm also a board member of the Land Care ACT. I work through the three catchment groups that are in the ACT. They do flow over the border a little bit, you know, like. That's only natural. But I'm also doing a little bit of other stuff as well, you know, like looking after the rock art sites up in Nemadji. So they're the only examples of rock art sites in the Southern Alps. So they're really important to us. Now, those nasty old fires we had in 2003 did a lot of damage to those art sites, and we're trying to figure out ways to remove some of the soot and stuff that came from the fires without damaging the artworks. Very slow process. At the moment, we're undertaking a monitoring program to see how much they're actually being affected upon by the exposure to the natural environments, because all the vegetation that did protect them was burned away, of course. But a lot of that's come back now, so it's looking good. Also working with Tidmanbilla. As you know, it's quite a significant place out there for us Aboriginal people. And I like to make sure that a lot of the places out there that are significant to us are looked after well as well. So I really am involved in a lot more than I can talk about, I guess. We'll be here all night talking about all the stuff that I'm involved with. But I really want to get on and talk about archaeology and Aboriginal involvement. So I guess you've had enough time to read through that anyway. Okay. This is the Ngunnawal boundary. I hope you can read it all. The boundary line itself follows waterways. Waterways were our pathways. They're very important elements for Aboriginal people Australia-wide. And, you know, like I keep saying in my walks and talks that I do, there's three elements that you need to survive. And one of them, the whole world needs, is water. So that's why we used to travel around along waterways, pathways. And that's why we're finding a lot of our archaeology around waterways. Natural, isn't it? As you can see, the ACT is within our boundary. So that's sort of makes things a bit different for us in working with ACT government and New South Wales government. And there's different layers of New South Wales government as well. So legislations are quite different. But, you know, you'd think that with that legislation that you're looking at protecting and conserving Aboriginal cultural heritage. But in some ways, if I can say it, I suppose it'd be a very tokenistic sort of approach. I've heard of Aboriginal sites that big companies have been aware of and informed about, and they've consulted with Aboriginal people about it, and next minute they're bulldozing through those sites. There was one instance where there was a site that was damaged by, you know, works that were taking place. OEH got onto them, the Office of Environment and Heritage, and imposed some fines on them. Now, out in New South Wales, you can get fined up to $1.1 million for damaging a site, either knowingly or unknowingly, which is quite different to the ACT. You have to know about sites, sort of thing, in the ACT. But with this site that got damaged, it was a multi-billion-dollar company that did the damage, and they were fined effectively about $2,000. You know, what would that mean to them? Nothing, you know? So that's what I mean about it. It's sort of a bit tokenistic in a way. They put all this legislation in place, but it's not effective in protecting Aboriginal culture, my culture. But, you know, legislation, I guess, is open to interpretation as well. People read things into words that are quite different to what we see. So, Canberra itself is, and I'm going to talk on a local level because this is my country, this is Ngunnawal country. So Canberra is on the ancestral lands of the Ngunnawal people. And we've been here for a bit longer than European occupation anyway. So there's been scientific testing done out at the Birragai Rock Shelter. And that was conducted by the Australian National University, and their testing has proven that that place was occupied for at least 25,000 years. Small in comparison to European occupation, isn't it? how long have Europeans been here? 250 years or something? So in that time, we've learned to live within country, harmonise with country. And that's how we go about it as Aboriginal people. And that's why we managed to survive for over 25,000 years in this area alone. Although Australia-wide, there's evidence that Aboriginal people have occupied this place for 40,000 plus, sometimes I think up in the north, Northern Territory, they're looking at something over 70,000 years. So. So Canberra itself was one of our, I guess, meeting places. Like I said, my people come from Yass area, Yar people. Yeah. So, but we used to travel over here all the time, and we used to come to one place. Oh, well, actually, two places. The first place we went to was a place called Black Mountain, and it sort of got that name from Europeans, because when Aboriginal people came, we settled down at the base of Black Mountain, and when European people were talking about the Aboriginal people, they'd say, "Well, that place over there, that's where all the blacks go, Black's Mountain." But so now they've managed to drop the S off it and call it Black Mountain. Yeah, political correctness, I guess. But there's a lot of archaeology throughout Black Mountain itself. The front gates to the National Botanical Gardens are built on top of one of our ceremonial sites. So we've lost that place forever. But luckily enough, there's a couple of other ceremonial sites here as well. There's also evidence of occupational sites all over the place in Black Mountain Reserve. So the occupation that took place here was in relation to the meeting up of Aboriginal people. My tribal boundary, I showed you before, we're surrounded by other tribal groups as well. I might see if I can go back. See if I can point. Down this area, we have Yuin people. Up here, bordering up here, is the Gunungurra people in the Blue Mountains area. Along here, we've got Wiradjuri people, Walgaloo, and Narrangu down that area. So, when we all got together, we used to come up to Black Mountain, get ready for ceremony, you know, meet up and have a good old time, chat about stuff. And then we'd move on over, and we used to take two routes over there, over to where our major meeting ground was. And that is now where Parliament House sits. So that's another place that we've lost. You know, all us Aboriginal people used to come there and meet, you know, all from all around the place, come there and meet at one major meeting ground. Now the politicians have stolen that away from us as well. They're doing that as well. coming from all around the country to meet at that place. There's a really good vibe about that place. And they said, well, the way I look at it is they must have said, well, if it's good enough for Aboriginal people to come here and meet, why can't we do the same thing? That's generally what people know about Canberra, is that it's a meeting place. And Canberra has got a lot of variations to the word. It's Canberra, you know, different ways of saying it. And that's because, you, like I said, there's different clan groups within the Ngunnawal people as well. You know, so we might be the same people, but we say things quite differently sometimes about the same, using the same word, but pronouncing it quite differently. So you got to keep those sort of things in mind as well. I thought I'd just point out some of the artifactual materials that we find around this place as well. You know, so a lot of these things are. Let me see now. Do some more pointing, I guess. Whoops, what have I done? Hit the wrong button. Technology.
It's a nut behind the wheel, isn't it?
Yeah, like these things. That'd be a hammer stain. You've got different sorts of hammer stains here. A lot of them are sort of broken ones as well. These are flake materials. Lacking in all the work that I do with looking after my culture is that all these places that we find with all these, you know, beautiful artifacts that get covered, you know, recovered or salvaged and put in the storage, you know. So that's what I was about to say, was that There's no story behind the things that we find, but there is a story there. It's just not told. Nobody wants to know that story. Well, if they do, you know, they don't tell me they do. And I'm quite open to telling those stories as well. There's all evidence of other things around as well, like scarred trees, for instance. They were used for different purposes. And again, you guys know all about these things, being archaeologists. And there's just an example of some of the scarred trees that are just within the ACT. Now, the other thing I've been doing recently is there's a Greening Australia got a heritage grant to go around and have a look at something that hasn't been done before. And that's these things. Ring trees. Okay, and we've been doing that for a few weeks now, just one day a week, but a full day. And it's quite surprising how many ring trees there are in the ACT. That one there is over near Hall. It's on the Barton Highway. When you're going out of Canberra and you've got that rest area, as soon as you're right where you pull in, there's a little drainage line, and that's right there. Yeah, and nobody's ever seen it before. This one is out on Canberra Pool Road. It's near the outside the Lions facility there, Lions Club facility, and this one. Where do you think that is? That should give you a clue. No. It's out at the Hall Cemetery. Right at the front entrance, the second front entrance to the cemetery itself. So we're sort of working on determining what each one sort of means, because with us, we do things for a reason, like I said, and we're trying to work out whether some of these trees are either women's business trees, which are indicate a fertility area, or whether they're markers pointing you in some sort of direction, and some of those are really doing that. You know, like we were up on Stirling Ridge the other day, and the ring trees up there are actually pointing to places like Mount Ainslie, which is a women's business site. Okay. So, you know, there's all these new elements that are coming out now, and all these things have got a story as well. Yeah, like I said, the cultural significance of this place is really high, and because we've occupied it for so long. Now, one place that's really important to my clan group, the Yar people, is the top of the falls at Ginnandira. Now, you've got two sets of falls out there on the Ginnandira Creek line. So the second lower down falls, that's sort of like a women's business area for procurement of food, things like yam daisy and stuff like that. But the top of the falls, at the main falls, is a men's initiation site. We generally don't give too much out about places like that because they're sacred areas. But in this instance, we sort of have to, because you're probably aware that there's a residential development that's going to take place out there. And the only way that we're going to be able to protect that place is by building up an awareness of what it is and what it means to us. So we've done a lot of archaeological work out there, and we've worked out where all the occupation sites are. But the story that I tell about this one, it all ties in with the Ginnandira Creek line, which originates up in Mulligan's Flat. Now, if you follow that creek line down, you'll find that most, and I only just worked this out, is that on if you're travelling down to the Murrumbidgee, following that water line down, all our occupation sites, with the exception of a couple, are on the left-hand side. Why? I don't know. But when you get closer to the falls, you'd understand why they travel down the left-hand side, because it's quite steep country out there. And there's we've done archaeology on the other side as well, and we've not found anything significant on that side, on the right-hand side going down. So the initiation site also has a side area upstream from it at the just where West McGregor, a recent residential development, finished up on the Ginnandira Creek line. There's an artefact scatter site there, and it's been recorded as a place that has the highest incidence of artefactual materials in the one place. But the most important part about that place is that it also tells the story about why it has so many artefacts there. Because just a little bit further away from that, on a spur line, is where we had our ceremony. It's a ceremonial site. And that's been test pitted, and we've recovered ochre materials that aren't from the area, so it sort of supports the story that it was a ceremonial site. Plus, there's also documentation from European residents in nearby suburbs about hearing the ceremony taking place over there, the corroboree, and we know where it is now. So archaeology is supporting us in trying to protect that area. So, you know, we can work hand in hand with archaeology, but there's sometimes a bit of a problem with working with archaeology because, and it's not because of ignorance or anything like that. I think it's because the story hasn't been told, and that's one of the things I'm trying to do, is tell that story about my culture and how the landscape has influenced that cultural practice as well. So we're looking at places that are quite important to us. But the problem, I guess, in places such as, you know, the Jindera Falls, with its very sacred, important initiation site, plus all the supporting evidence of occupation right along the creek line itself, all the way from Mulligan's Flat, there's... I guess it's a lack of understanding, because from an this is my personal point of view, and that is that archaeology looks primarily at scientific evidence, tactile evidence, stuff you can see, stuff you can feel. So when we're talking about, well, this initiation site, there's no real evidence that it ever was used for that, because they're places that have a spiritual element to them. And how do you explain something that you can't touch or feel or see? You know, like... how would you compare it? Like European people, for instance, would build places of worship, you know, like churches and things like that. Whereas Aboriginal people use the natural environment, natural landscape features, for that purpose, because we have a strong connection with country. What else have I got? Well, I'm touching on these sort of things now, like the tangible versus the intangible. As you can see there, there's a rock art site. And that's one of our rock art sites up in the Madgee. But you can see it, so you can understand it. You can relate to it. Yet the other one, you know, the photo of a tree. And that's my father standing there, and he was one of his duties, responsibilities, to make sure that tree wasn't damaged. Because that's a tree that we call a mourning tree. It's where people went to mourn people that had passed away. And that's supported because at that particular project... there's burial sites in very close proximity. And there's a very special burial out there as well, which belongs to one of the medicine men for our people, which is a very special stone arrangement. So we know it's for somebody that's of importance. But, you know, like... my dad fought really hard on that project to have that tree protected. As you can see, they put a fence around it. Very flimsy little fence, but it's... and it was also a fence that was moved. Like, we asked for a fairly good buffer zone around it, so they all agreed to it. So they put that fence in, but they actually moved it so they could put in that track. And these sort of things happen all the time, and this is where I'm talking about, you know, cultural awareness, cultural understanding. You know, for us, that's an important place.
But how do we get that across? Because it's, you know, anybody looking at it, it's just a tree. But it's a place that's significant to us. And that's where we have difficulty in trying to get those things across. Now, heritage is all these things. And these are all the things that we used to do. Because we were told, or you get told about how Aboriginal people never looked after the land or never knew how to do all these sort of things. But it's things that we did. You know, we've got our human remains that were you know, dug up and sent overseas to the British Museum to be studied, you know, and things like that. We have all sorts of cultural places around the place that are just misunderstood or not understood at all. So, you know, we're working from our cultural side, but sometimes it's just like you think that you're doing the proverbial banging your head against the wall type thing. I've spent a lot of time. I was doing some wet sieving with an archaeologist, and I spent the whole day standing next to this person, talking about my culture. At the completion of that project, this person had written up their draft report. And when I was reading through it, they'd come to a little place section in there that said, Aboriginal people don't divulge information about this place. But I was thinking, well, I've just spent a whole day talking to you about it, telling you about what it means to me as an Aboriginal person, you know. Why are you saying this in the report? The report, in the end, had that little bit taken out, but there was nothing else put in its place. There was no cultural understanding side of it. The cultural element was missing from that report. So those sort of things make it a little bit difficult for me as a normal man trying to talk about my culture, and it's not being told to anybody. You know, look, there's a lot of stuff that gets said in conversation that is probably taken out of context or not given the proper value that it should have. It's quite easily dismissed. But then again, you look at the fact that as Aboriginal people, again, we're bound by our own protocols, our own law, L-O-R-E law, that says that we're allowed to talk about stuff to a certain degree. We can't tell you the insides, practical elements of that story, because we're not allowed to by our own people. And it's knowledge and culture that's been passed down for thousands of years. It's not that we don't want to tell you about it, it's just that we're bound by our law to not tell you about it. We can say, you know, that place is significant to us, and we can say why, but we can't tell you the inside story about the whole thing, because we'd be breaking our own law. In the old days, that would have been punishable by, you know, spear in the leg or something like that. And you know, like, it's not just us that have this problem, you know, the Aboriginal people of Australia, but it's a problem worldwide with different cultures. And good old UNESCO were trying to come up with a proper definition of what intangible cultural heritage is. I'll let you have a little bit of a read of that. So, as you can see, like I said, there's different cultures around the world that have the same problem in talking about spiritual places. So, you know, like a lot of the three listed at the bottom there, folklore or in our case, dreaming, our dreaming stories. Our oral history or song lines about certain places. And then again, the other thing is our language. We've lost a lot of our language, but we're trying to revive some of that at the moment. We lost our language due to government process. For a long time, they thought they were doing the right thing, protecting the poor old Aboriginal people, putting them on missions and telling them that, you know, you need to learn to be a white fella. You're not allowed to talk your language. You're not allowed to carry out your cultural practice. And that's how we lost a lot of our language and our culture. But my dad, he was on the Hollywood mission over in Yass. Well, it was Hollywood Reserve, but everybody calls it a mission. He was there, and he told me the story about how, he was born there as well. But he was telling me how they were told those things. You know, don't talk your language, don't carry out your practice, cultural practice. But he said, with a wink in his eye, he said, but we used to sneak off and do it anyway. You know, we'd just go down by the Yass River there and keep on carrying out our culture. And that's why my dad, he was such a knowledgeable man. And that's how I've learnt so much from my dad as well. And that's where I'm hoping to be able to carry out what my dad's set out to do. We're also, at the moment, we're working with the Australian Institute of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Studies to try and revive our language. It's a hard process because of the fact that a lot of our senior elders have passed away, and they're the ones that were still able to speak our language fluently. And we're trying to bring it back because we think it's quite necessary for us to be able to relate who we are while on country. Yeah, Aboriginal places. Now, as I've already sort of said, that they don't have a lot of, archaeological indicators about, what they are. Because they are places that are spiritually significant to us. And by that I mean they're places that we frequently come back to. Because we have a belief in country. We believe country is where we come from. We're here for a little while as custodians. And then that's another story, I guess. We're here for a little while as custodians, and then we return to the country. And that's why when I do a welcome to country, I call upon the spirit of the land, which is also my ancestral spirits, because that's where everybody is. It's our cultural belief that's where we all are. We have our dreaming stories. Our main one is about the creation of this country for us by our creator being. We call our creator being Bujabuya, which is a serpent. And that serpent, Bujabuya, lives in a place called Noongarra. Nobody knows where Noongarra is, do they? Everybody else knows it by another place. Noongarra in Donegal is flat water. Bit of a hint. flat water, big flat water, Lake George. Now, Noongahla is formed by Budjibuya. So what happened there is Budjibuya was sleeping. You know that big long escarpment you got running along the side of the road as you go into Sydney? That's where Budjibuya sleeps, because he's nestled up against there and pushed it all up. Yeah, the geologists will tell you different, but that's where our creator being is and still is today. Now, Lake George, Noongahla, was made by Budjibuya one day when he woke up and he was feeling really happy. So he looked around and he saw, you know, bright blue skies, sunshine, and he was feeling a bit cramped from sleeping for so long. So he starts rolling around. And he rolled around and rolled around. And he's made Noongahla. He's made it nice and flat. Because you've got the escarpment where he was sleeping, then you've got the other side with what's there now? The Capital Wind Farm. Up on those hills, you know. So after a while, he stopped rolling around and he decided to travel around. So he moves off down past Bungador that way. And what's he doing when he's doing all this? He's forming the landscape for us, making places for us to survive. What's he making? The most important element of all, water. He's not making the water, but he's making the rivers so that we can travel along through country. So all those rivers around the place, you know, the Molonglo River and the Queanbeyan River and all those places. Now, what's one of the features of rivers? How do they run? Do they run in straight lines? That's all right. They move like a snake. You know, that's why they call them winding rivers, because they follow the pattern of a snake. So the Budjibuya has made this landscape for us. And that's why we respect the land. That's why we consider ourselves to be custodians. A lot of people like to refer to Aboriginal people as being the owners of the land. Us in particular, we like to be called custodians because we're here to care for the land, take care of it, because we have this strong belief that, like I said before, we come from the land. We need to look after it so that we can survive while we're up here and running around. And to do that, we need to make sure the country is well cared for, so they can provide us with whatever we need to survive. When you look at those sort of elements, that's the story side of stuff that I guess on a lot of projects you don't talk about with archaeologists because they're too busy doing the scientific side of stuff. I'd like to be able to do more of the story, the telling that about the landscape, because, like I said, it's a cultural place for us. It's where we come from, and it's where we belong, and we have so many stories to tell about the land, but we don't get asked those sort of questions about the land. It's the more tangible side of stuff that archaeology is focused on. You know, we can respect that because we also need that tangible scientific side of stuff. But there's also the intangible side as well, which is important to us because it's about our culture. It's about the land itself. And we never get that opportunity to do these sort of things. So, country, like it says there, you know, it's our belonging place. So it's where we come from. It's where we go back to. It's where we belong. And that's, again, part of that spiritual connection with land. And we also believe that all these artifactual materials that come from the land that are made, you know, the stone tools and things like that are made from the elements from the land have a spiritual connection with the land still. And that's why we call for what we refer to as a return to country. It's where we want those artifactual materials, instead of being stored in a filing cabinet or something in some warehouse, to be returned to country, so the spiritual connection is remade, so that, you know, like, spirit is everything for us, and that's why we need to work on that side of stuff as well. It doesn't happen as frequently as it should. Again, the importance of scientific evidence outweighs the cultural side of stuff, which doesn't really fit too well with me, because I call for the return to country of all our artifactual materials that are salvaged, saved, if you know what I mean. The tactile materials are saved, but then if you got a residential development taking place, what happens there? The land is, the whole lot of it's removed. You know, you have a record of there being an artifact scatter site where somebody sat around and made tools, but you can't go back and look at it. It's no longer there. So we lose a lot of our culture that way. But, you know, it's sad, I guess, in a way, because we do understand the fact that culture that's thousands of years old won't be able to stand in the way of progress. Which is going to happen a whole lot more these days, I guess. There's all these stories that we need to talk about. You know, like, we have natural landscape features. And again, I've already touched on it about how they're important to us from a spiritual side, because there's places that we go to still to do things that to anybody else would look like just a natural landscape feature. Now, we know about these places because of the fact that elders have passed on this information, and all our history is oral. The reasoning behind why it's oral is that if we wrote stuff down, there'd be no need for elders anymore. Elders are the people that are our knowledge holders. I think we've got something about them as well. Because they actually teach us all about cultural values. Social values. They're our spiritual and traditional values that are handed down by our elders over thousands of years. They're things that we still listen to today. And they tell us stories about the natural landscape features, those places that we need to go to reinvigorate ourselves. One of those places that you guys could even go to now in central urban area, such as, well, it's out at Gungahlin in a place called Franklin. And that place is called Gubbadada, Red Acre Ground. It's our acre procurement site. But it's a significant place, not only for the acre procurement, but it's also a place of spiritual reconnection. And I feel that reconnection every time I go there. And I've had non-Aboriginal people say to me as well, they feel really at ease when they go to this place. It's like I said, it's a really spiritual place. And there are other things that our elders tell us about as well. There's things that have happened. There's good things and there's bad. And you don't, like we like to tell the whole story. So we have a good history about the good things that have happened. We've got a history of the bad things that have happened as well. And a lot of those bad things, non-Aboriginal people don't like to talk about because they're bad. Yeah, so that first sentence sort of says it in a way. When you talk to Aboriginal people, if you've got different tribal groups, then you probably use the same place, like the meeting place that's no longer there at Parliament House. Their interpretations of that would be quite different probably to the way we see things as non-war people. You know, the Wagaloo or the Narigu probably think of it as quite differently to the way we look at it. Although it's similar in some of the story, but it'll be quite different the way they tell it. And that's probably why, in the second sentence there, because they have a different relationship to it, different way of looking at it. Because when you look at Australia wide, there's over 400 different tribal groups, and within that you've got over 700 different language groups as well. So, of course, that story is going to be told differently, isn't it? With so many variations in there. But it's all going to be quite have a strong similar vein running through it. So it's one of those things there, like this local government, for instance, consultation with Aboriginal people. You'd think that being recognised as being Ngunnawal country, that the first people they go to talk to about country would be the Ngunnawal people. But for the local government, for them, consultation is with Aboriginal people who have different story because they have different cultural backgrounds. How they can work their way through that, I don't know. They're sort of coming at it from an angle that wants to be, what'd they tell me? We've got to be all-inclusive. You know, that old phrase. So, yeah. And, you know, like I think I've covered most of what's in that slide about, you know, the complexities and different social values and all those sort of things that Aboriginal people have Australia-wide. Again, connection with country is quite strong. It's quite important to us as Aboriginal people. Not only here as a Ngunnawal man on a local level, but Australia wide. because every different Aboriginal group, like I said, there's, you know, 400 plus tribal groups, and they have different cultural beliefs because of the changes in natural environment. They've got different plants and things like that as compared to here, you know. So a lot of the culture is based on the natural environment, the natural elements out there that we needed for thousands of years to survive. So we've learned to harmonise with the natural environment and learn to live within that environment. So which means then that there's different story. You know, like our story here is going to be quite different to the people down, the Yuin people down on the coast. Because they're down on the coast, they're looking at, the sea, which is going to provide a whole lot more different food sources than we have up here, you know. So there's got to be a different story, doesn't there? A simple fact of where you live within Australia. You know, desert people have got a different story to us because their vegetation is quite different. Although, like I said, we've still got that same cultural vein that runs through us as Aboriginal people, those stories and practices and beliefs are going to be just a little bit different. So, you know, culture, like I said, cultures are different. Even our culture changes according to where we're at. And that's why as Aboriginal people we lead a very nomadic, or used to lead a very nomadic lifestyle. People talk about the seasons. European people have four different seasons, whereas we have six, but we don't call them seasons. You know, that's a European interpretation of the climatic changes that happen around the place. Ours are based on our seasonal changes. Well, see, I've got to use seasonal there. Our pattern of life was based on the vegetation patterns within our tribal boundary, because we used to interact with the natural environment. We learned how different plants and things ripened and all that sort of thing at different times all over the place. So we had to move around as well, because we didn't want to also deplete those food sources and at certain places, so we just kept moving around. And that's just quite basic skills that we learnt. And like I said, we've got six different seasonal patterns. I'll have to think of a better word than season when I talk about these things, eh? Alrighty. So what I've been talking about then is probably where you're looking at cultural difference between the tactile, tangible evidence based against the spiritual, cultural side of stuff for us. And so from my way of looking at it, we need to learn more about Aboriginal cultures to be able to understand culture, Aboriginal culture. Like I said, there's 400 different tribal groups, and wherever you're working within Australia, if you
want to learn more about that certain area of country, you know, like here on what, the Southern Tablelands compared to arid country in the Northern Territory, you're going to have to talk to the people here about those sort of things. You got to look around, and you got to find the right people to talk to. A place like Canberra, you know, and it's quite difficult in trying to find the right people, because not all the Ngunnawal people live here in Canberra. And a lot of the consultation that takes place is with Aboriginal people who have come here to live. And they bring with them their own cultural story, which is different to the Ngunnawal story for this country. That's one of those difficulties I've always had for a long time about, you know, being an RIA. I mean, this place is being identified by the government as being Ngunnawal country, yet they're consulting with every Aboriginal person they can see on the street. But, you know, not like that, but that's what it seems like to me. Talking to people and listening. There's a lot of people that listen, but do they hear what they're being told? And I don't think they are, because they have to go through that process. You know, like it's a tick-the-box exercise. So, you know, like they'll sit down and say, well, yes, I've consulted with the Aboriginal people, I've gone through, you know, under OEH, for instance, you have to go through the consultation process. They've even got a consultation protocol that you have to follow. But still, it's not happening like it should, you know, not from my point of view anyway. Because people don't, like I said, I spent a whole day talking with this archaeologist and she never heard a word I said. Yeah. And then you got to learn. Learn that our culture is different. Not only for the Ngunnawal people, but for each different area that you're working in as an archaeologist around the country. It's quite different. You know, and I've already said it, how the cultures are practiced differently because of the different environmental parts of Australia that you're in. And being able to understand that is important. And I'll leave with that. I think I've said enough. So now.
Does anyone have any questions for Wally?
Is it on? Yeah. I'm not an archaeologist, but I'm very interested in Australian history. And what I wonder is, if you go out with an archaeologist for the whole day, why can't you agree beforehand? Now, I can tell you a whole lot of things which you're perfectly welcome to write down. There are other things that, like a journalist might have with someone. And then, like a politician, you know, certain things I'll tell you, but you're not allowed to publish them. I'm thinking that someone like John Mulvaney must have done that with Mungo Woman, because he consulted widely with the people there. And then you get to have a look at what was written up, and you get to have a say about what was written up. Is that possible?
Yeah, but that instance I was talking about was where there was a failure for on behalf of that person to listen and learn and take on board what I was saying. They were more interested in finding artifacts or materials than listening and learning about the cultural landscape that I was talking about, that we were working in. I mean, you probably touched on a bit there with, artistic license about what they put into a report. And there's no, what would you call it, direct requirement to have them actually report what's been told to them. But I guess when you're looking at somebody that totally forgets about stuff that you're talking about, maybe they're not listening. I don't know if that's the answer you wanted, but to me it's sort of not happening in the way that it should be these days, because there should be more awareness, or cultural awareness, and that's something that needs to be built upon, I suppose, in the places that they're studying in as well.
I'm not an archaeologist either. I'm just interested in history. And you made a comment that your elders pass on all the information, and if it wasn't for them, that then there would be no need for the elders. Are they being recorded for all the information that they have to pass on to your younger generations? Because there'll always be a place for elders to make sure that it's being passed on correctly. So is there something that's happening today for that history of yours to be recorded and recorded correctly?
That's like I touched on it before about how under our own law we're not allowed to divulge certain elements of our culture, and that's something that I don't think there's a way around it, because it's our law, unless there's a change in how being allowed to do that under law, it'll just continue as it is, I think.
If you want people to actually understand everything, surely there must be a way around that, because people won't understand if you can't pass on the complete story.
There is a way of telling things without getting into the detail. So that's where we don't like to give a full description about, say, men's initiations and things like that, because those are sacred practices that we carry out, and if we divulge those sort of things, you know, like in the old day, those things were, if you broke those law, they were punishable.
You mentioned about artifact scatters, and you said you don't like them being gathered up and put into buildings or on shelves and so on, and you'd like them back. Where would you put them? Who would you give them to? How would you preserve their integrity?
Yeah, I thought I'd explain that we're trying to develop a return to country policy. Now, that means that we want to have all those artifactual materials returned to where they came from. So that means that we actually rebury them so that that spiritual connection with country is remade. Because, like I said, we believe in the spiritual side of those artifacts or materials being disconnected when they're taken away to be analysed and stuff like that. So we want that spiritual reconnection, and which means that we need them to be brought back to where they come from. Or in the case of a, you know, like a residential development where you can't, a place that's close by and that won't be impacted by any future developments.
So you're saying that the stone tools and flakes and so on that are found, if they're returned to you, for example, some found in Karen Forest or on the Tuggeranong Valley and so on, if you found them by, if they were found by a creek in the Tuggeranong Valley, you want them put back there?
Yes.
And what's to prevent them being moved again or taken?
Well, we conduct investigations about certain areas of land that, you know, like crown leases and stuff like that, that won't be impacted or taken away. So if we can find places like that, that's an ideal location for that return to country. If there's nothing like that available, we'd like to try and look at places that are protected under law, such as nature reserves and things like that, or even a national park like Nemadji.
So it's not really an integrity, but it's as close as you can get to what...
Yes.
Thank you.
Wally, thank you. My name's Jenny. The comment first. There seemed to be some connection between the cultural landscape and the physical landscape that could inform a lot of the archaeological sites in Europe as well, if the conversation could ever be held, because I've been sitting here fascinated. My question's very specific. It's about Ginninderra Creek. You mentioned the sites were on the left of the creek. There's some understanding around the suburbs where I live that there used to be an occupation site under what is now the Melba shop on Kingsford Smith. Do you have any information about the exception to the left of the creek and whether, in fact, there was a big settlement to the right of the creek in Melba?
Yeah, I sort of indicated that the majority of the sites were along the left-hand side, with the exception of a few that are on the right-hand side. The creek line near the suburb of Crace, there's a hilltop that's got artifacts or materials up on top of it, which is on the right-hand side as you're travelling down. There's also the CSIRO site as well, and that's got a... thousands of artifacts through there as well. So there are exceptions to every rule, of course, but the landscape lends itself to those sort of situations. And I'm guessing where Lake Ginninderra is, where the dam wall is, there's also artificial materials on the right-hand side up in that area up there as well. Landscape features are the main determiners, I suppose, of where people sat as well. So,
thank you, Wally. My name's Larissa. I'm a high school teacher. Very keen to connect with some Ngunnawal teachers. We have done at our public school before, but I'm very curious about... I'm a language teacher, and I'm very curious as to how soon your Ngunnawal Revival Project might see the introduction of basic language in schools, because I think there's a really strong connection between respect, understanding and language.
Yeah. We've already had a pilot program trialled at Fraser Primary School, and using language we taught children how to do the head, shoulders, knees and toes song. You know, it's basic, but I guess that's where you got to start from. So we want to try and introduce our language into school. Like I said, we're working with IATSEs to recover our language, and again, like I said, it's a slow process because our fluently speaking elders have no longer with us, so we need to work on what we've got, and also, as we've been told, that we'll probably need to create some words as well. So that's all part of the language revival process. Is that what you wanted? I mean, there is pilot, like I said, that pilot program, and we're working on doing some more in schools.
Yeah, we've had an Aboriginal education officer that I've brought into the classroom, but unfortunately, being Wiradjuri, it doesn't feel quite right. So, yeah.
And I respect him for that. Yep.
Yeah, it's going to be nice to have that connection for the kids.
Yeah.
Any more questions?
Hi, Wally. Thanks for sharing your knowledge and culture today. I just had a question from, I guess, a student perspective. I think might be a few from the ANU student group. And just that it's, I guess, when you're doing student research, it's quite difficult, as you say, to follow correct processes and procedures and to know what the protocols are when you're coming onto maybe a country which you're quite new to, particularly if you've moved from somewhere else. I just wondered if you had any kind of takeaway messages for any students here about how you would like to see students go about working on your country and researching on non-Aboriginal country.
Well, I think students coming into the ACT are going to find it quite difficult. Like I said, there's so many Aboriginal people that have come here, and as was just mentioned, there's a lot of Wiradjuri people here as well. So it's a major problem because there's no really set process in place whereby there's like happens in other places where they've got want of a better word, I guess, a register of the local people, because in New South Wales it's quite difficult as well because they've got the local Aboriginal land councils, and a lot of those places don't consist of the local Aboriginal people. And the ACT is pretty much, it doesn't have local Aboriginal land councils, but it's pretty much in the same boat. They have a lot of Aboriginal organisations here, local government. They've got two bodies, United and Ngunnawal Elders Council, and the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Advisory Body. And members on there aren't solely Ngunnawal people. So you're looking again at, it's really hard for people in your situation, I guess, to deal with the right people. But how do you get around that? I really haven't got a solution to it. It's a knowledge thing, I guess, where you've got to know the right people, if you know what I mean. Yeah.
As an ex-ANU employee, possibly to go to the Jabal Centre to speak to the the director there to get some pointers as to which Aboriginal organisations in Ngunnawal country that they could go and talk to. And there's also the, you know, the contacts through the yourself and the other RAOs. But as an ANU student, that might be the first place that they can go to because it's on campus.
Hmm.
For people in this room as well. Thank you for Wally to giving us this such broad view, but just one specific thing. As Canberra keeps on growing and we're expanding across to Ginninderra Falls, sadly, it's across in New South Wales, that wonderful ceremonial area, and there's very little dialogue between our ACT Assembly and the Yass Valley Council. In fact, a group I'm in, we've had to try and do the heavy lifting. So it's the parliamentary process that's lacking. And the ACT Heritage Council, there's no interaction. And they just do a Pontius Pilate and wash their hands of these issues. So, and the tragedy is, I'm showing my age now, if we had the NCDC today, you'd have good quality, independent Aboriginal people advising what the government should do. But now, this development down towards Ginninderra Falls is run by the Land Development Agency and a developer. You can't blame both of them. You must blame our ACT Assembly. And the next thing I want to say, you say, we must harmonise with your stay on the Ngunnawal country, all of us here. Well, how can we harmonise when we know that the only way you survived over millennia was by looking after country? All we worry about is economic growth, population growth. Most of our food's coming from long way away from here. We've got no understanding of sustainability of food supply. There was a wonderful guy here in the Fenner School, Professor Duncan Brown, and said, when our civilization so-called moved away from your lifestyle to villages, cities and industrialisation, that was our end. So we in this room, we really can't harmonise because we're locked into a way of life which will go in a matter of centuries. We won't be round here like you were for 25 grand.
Probably a good note to end on. one more? Sorry. Yep, go ahead.
Thanks, Wally, for the lecture tonight. As you know, I'm not an archaeologist, nor am I a politician. But I was just interested in that UNESCO definition on the tangible and intangible values. And it's probably good to say this tonight whilst the majority of the people in the room are non-Aboriginal. From my understanding, not all countries worldwide have become signatories, and I'm not quite sure where Australia is, whether they signed or thinking of becoming a signatory to that UNESCO statements. But as Wally said, there's over 400 tribal groups here in Australia, and we all come with our different cultures and our different values. I'm one of the Aboriginal people that have been in Canberra for a very long time, but I'm not a Ngunnawal man. And I need to listen to the Ngunnawal people before I make decisions about what's going to happen. And I'm a part of that process of people including me in the inclusiveness of decision-making processes. So having said that, because we do have a variation in our cultures and our values, it's very important that people like who are in this room have that understanding about whether we should be a signatory to those customs, because as Wally's pointed out, we all grow up in different households where we get our norms and values. We all grow up in different countries where we get our norms and values and cultures.
Please thank Wally Bell.
Thank you, Wally. It's only a very small token of appreciation, but on behalf of CAS and on behalf of the Friends of the Museum, thank you. It was
thank you very much.
Informative lecture.
Hey, it was my pleasure. I'd just like to say thank you very much for listening, but we've still got a long way to go. And by my doing this sort of thing, hopefully that I'm instilling some sort of thought out there that you guys could espouse for me, I guess. Thank you very much.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.